You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Fraternities are a major part of the social life at many universities. They offer their members room and board, friendships, and they claim leadership training. But as Atlantic Monthly magazine contributor, it's not called the Monthly anymore, is it?
It's just called the Atlantic Magazine now.
Atlantic Magazine contributing editor Caitlin Flanagan discovered during a year-long investigation, fraternities have a complex system for shifting liability when injuries, assaults, and deaths occur. Her article, The Dark Power of Fraternities, explores the influence these organizations have in colleges and universities, why so many of them can be unsafe, and the legal battles that kind of stem from those two facts. It's in the March issue of the magazine. I'm very pleased to welcome her to our show today. Hello.
Hi.
How are you?
Thanks for having me.
You write that in many ways fraternities are now more powerful than the universities and colleges that host them. In what way?
Well, people often think that the fraternities have to answer to the colleges and that the colleges run the fraternities in some way, and that's not true at all. The fraternities are completely private societies that operate on private land. And
they're usually off campus or always off campus?
Well, that's a big question. For the most part, they're off the campus technically. They're on privately owned land. Sometimes they're not. There's a lot of interconnections there. But the colleges depend on the fraternities for this huge amount of housing. One out of every eight American undergraduates lives in a Greek housing. So it's a huge amount of housing the colleges don't have to pay for, maintain, or insure. And then fraternity men are phenomenally good givers to their alma maters. They send a lot of money back each year. And so colleges are loath to alienate them and loath to sort of bully them around, as the fraternities claim. So the colleges have more to gain from the fraternities than vice versa.
Aren't most frat houses just chapters of national organizations?
Definitely the ones that I talked about are, but the nationals are very careful in distancing themselves in certain ways from the locals, because the more that the national distances itself from a local chapter, the less duty of care it has when something goes wrong, and the more it can limit its liability when there is a disaster.
American fraternities even have their own political action committee.
It's the largest political action committee devoted solely to higher education. So they pump a lot of money through Washington to make sure that they get what they want.
Are they mostly lobbying? Do they tend to support one party over the other?
I would say that they are more Republican than Democrat, former fraternity men. That's just off the top of my head. But what they're interested in is making sure that in the public universities they're that no laws get passed that stop kids from living in fraternity houses, and no laws come through that jeopardize the non-status profit of the fraternities.
But aren't public universities prohibited by law from banning fraternities even if they want to?
Absolutely. They absolutely are. The young men have a right, you know, constitutionally granted right to the freedom of association. It's an implied right from the freedom of assembly. And so you can't tell your students that you can't belong to a private society, just as you can't tell them they can't belong to the Elks Club or the local Italian society. They have the right to belong to an off-campus club, so you can't forbid them.
What are the most common accidents that happen at American fraternities?
That was probably what surprised me most in writing the essay. I assumed it would be hazing, because that's what we always hear about, are these terrible hazing incidents. But in the long course of reporting this story, I came across an internal document of the fraternity industry. It's a chart showing the most common kinds of insurance claims against them. Hazing's the least common.
Although it is still common.
Yes, but it's only 7%. So certainly there is hazing, but far more frequent. Number one, assault and battery. These kids get really liquored up and they fight. There's a few days ago, there's still a kid in a coma in Pennsylvania. He broke up a fight at his fraternity house, got badly hit, struck his head, and he's in a coma right now. That's number one, assault and battery. Number two that I think every parent should look at is sexual assault. 15% of all claims that come to fraternities are for the sexual assault of young women. And so that sort of shows you in a very clear, dramatic way that when women talk about sexual assault being common in fraternity houses, there are some numbers and statistics to back that up.
The women have come to fraternity parties.
Typically,
and then there's a lot of drinking.
Yes, drinking is the through line through everything. Now, what that has to do with consent and non-consent, et cetera, is a separate but related issue. But certainly the huge majority of rapes that I see in lawsuits are where the woman has become blotto on alcohol, doesn't really even know where she is, and ends up being sexually assaulted.
And you're right about binge drinking being an epidemic on American campuses, both for boys and girls.
Mm-hmm.
What exactly is different today from the drinking and drug use that was common during the 60s and the 70s?
Well, drug use is a separate issue, but the drinking, ever since in the mid-80s when the drinking age became 21 across the country, that moved. There was a lot of drinking before that was like the keg party on campus, and you had administrators and even professors, you know, monitoring it. The beer was kind of watered down. You had to be 18 at least to drink it, so the most of the kids were old enough to drink it. But as soon as the law changed, all those kind of on-campus keg parties disappeared. Drinking was pushed off campus. It really switched to hard alcohol because you could drink it more quickly and then go back on campus if there was something going on. So there's a real intensity of imbibing a huge amount of hard alcohol in a very short amount of time.
And I've always wondered what kind of pleasure people get from drinking to the point where they get sick or they can't remember what happened.
That, I think, is a real generational change. I think in younger generations, there was an idea you're going to, quote unquote, learn how to drink. Maybe you got sick a few times. Maybe you even couldn't remember what happened a few times. But then that was kind of a learning curve of learning how to drink was an old-fashioned idea of not that long ago. But today, for the young people, you know, even after they've been drinking several years, the plan is to get really messed up. If you're a girl, you're going to have someone hold your hair when you throw up. You know you're going to throw up. That's part of the plan.
Do universities have any way to control or limit drinking at off-campus sites?
They have no legal ability to do that whatsoever. Do they have a moral responsibility to their students in terms of drinking? That's a big open-ended question and no one's sure. Some people say they're over 18. It's their time to deal with the cops if they got caught drinking, not with their college. College doesn't act in loco parentis anymore. It's not there to give them an upbringing. It's just there to provide them an education. So, and colleges are morally motivated to try to take care of this problem. Legally, they're motivated not to take care of it because, again, the more you try to put in rules, the more you become liable when they break the rules.
Do national fraternity organizations have much incentive to discourage drinking?
Well, that's a very important question. They have risk management policies that are incredibly strict around drinking. And I think most parents would be shocked who have sons who are in fraternities how little alcohol you're allowed to drink when you're in a fraternity. You have to be over 21. If it's a party, you can't have any more than 6 beers. You can't ever have a keg in a fraternity party. And all of these things are part of their risk management policy. Now, I could take you to any fraternity party on a weekend. You're going to see the exact opposite most places, not all, but most places of what those policies are. The minute the kids violate some of these strict policies, if there is a lawsuit, they've lost their fraternity insurance. They're going to get dropped from the fraternity. And guess who's going to pay the claim? Mom and Dad will pay the claim from their homeowner's insurance.
So those rules are simply a way of the nationals to protect themselves against liability.
Well,
we told them not to do it, and they ignored us.
I've talked to senior men in the fraternity industry, and I found them a much more impressive group than I expected them to be.
And you call it an industry?
They call themselves an industry, because I thought when I would hear it referred to as an industry, I would say that must be a pejorative term from anti-fraternity people. But no, they're all over their paperwork. They call it an industry. But anyways, these senior men will say, we're very upfront about our policies, and if you break our policies, you're going to be in a huge amount of trouble. And they say that the real problem in fraternities is that there's a whole generation now of kids coming to college whose parents have gotten them out of trouble every single time they messed up in high school. Didn't like a grade, mom and dad rushed to the school and made sure it got changed. We're going to get suspended for an infraction, mom and dad took care of that. Cracked up the car, mom and dad repaired it and paid for their insurance. The fraternity say there are all these people who come to college, they've never learned to be grown-ups, and we're holding them accountable. If they get drunk and they make a mistake, we're not going to support them in this.
Often after an accident or some other problem, the national organization will encourage members to fill out questionnaires. Why?
Well, that's the first thing that'll happen is when the bad stuff really goes down, somebody's drunk himself to death in an upstairs bedroom, there's been a sexual assault, the cops have come over. There's a strict protocol. You get all guests out of the house. You call up all members who aren't there. You bring everybody to the fraternity house and lock the door. And then you call the national office. And the national office typically will send someone out to help you out, so you think. They'll often email you questionnaires. Exactly what happened? Give me all the detail you can. Be completely forthcoming to us about this. The young men will assume incorrectly, oh, thank goodness, someone's come from the national, the grown-ups, they'll get us out of it. In fact, all those statements and questionnaires will often be used against the fraternity members in a legal situation to put the blame on them where it actually resides, but it's kind of a catch-22.
And this is done by the Fraternal Information and Programming Group of the FIPG?
The FIPG, when you pledge a fraternity, you may think you've joined this frat or that frat, but in a lot of cases, you've really joined this organization called FIPG that binds many of the fraternities together in terms of a set of risk management protocols. And if you violate those risk management protocols, you're in for a big legal consequence if you mess up.
They maintain a manual of best practices, and you write, I'm quoting, if the manual were Anna Karenina, alcohol policy would be its farming reform, the buzz-killing subplot that quickly reveals itself to be an authorial obsession. The manual encourages frats to bring your own booze parties.
Right. They don't want to have the liability for any alcohol, so they'll say, make your party a BYO party. Bring in each bottle of booze, assign it to the person who brought it, and any liability with each individual bottle goes to that person who brought it.
And then they want you to keep a guest list?
They have a guest list which acts as a witness list. In that situation that something goes wrong, they have a whole set of witnesses to turn over to their lawyers.
This is all about legal matters.
It is.
My guest is Caitlin Flanagan of Atlantic Magazine. Her article, The Dark Power of Fraternities, is in the March issue of the magazine. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Caitlin Flanagan, who is a contributing editor at The Atlantic, and her article, The Dark Power of Fraternities, is in the March issue. Falls are extremely common, I guess, because of the alcohol. Go ahead.
Yeah. There was a case a few years ago. A young woman named Amanda Andeverde launched a big lawsuit against the University of Idaho. She'd gone to a frat party. She'd hooked up with a guy on a third floor bedroom and rolled over in bed, fell out of the bed, and was seriously injured with permanent brain damage three stories up. I thought, that's got to be kind of a fluke thing. And then I started studying and finding out this bizarre fact that kids with some regularity get really drunk. They're in these rambling houses. They're kind of used to either being at home with mom and dad where things were safe, or they're used to the dorm that has lots and lots of safety standards and building standards. A lot of these fraternities have radically different safety and building code standards than the dorms do. They're huge rambling old spaces. The kids are out of their minds on alcohol. They're forever. The guys are always opening a window to pee out of it and then pitching forward, or they're trying to vomit out and they pitch forward that way. They climb out on drain pipes. They go out on the fire escape. They take a slip. And I'm always kind of amazed how few kids they do. There is a lot of paralysis and head injury, but if people our age were to have these kind of falls, we'd be dead in an hour because they're really terrible falls. And this is another issue where parents sue the fraternities and the fraternities say, your kid consumed the alcohol of his or her own free will. It's hard to get to recover damages.
Now, what would have happened if this had occurred in a dorm room? The university would have been responsible.
Exactly. I mean, the fact
But here nobody seems to be responsible.
The person, she did not recover any money at all, and she's permanently brain damaged.
Because the fraternities, the national fraternities, have found a way to protect themselves.
Right. Well, the parents also sued the university. It's really hard to recover money from a public university. There's sovereign immunity and damage caps and many other reasons you can't get much money out of a public university. But the court found that she had made the decision to drink. She'd made the decision to go to the fraternity. She'd made the decision to lie down in a bed that was next to an open window. It was her responsibility what happened to her from there on.
But there are also a number of bizarre accidents that you chronicle, including someone who injured himself trying to shoot a bottle rocket out of a part of his body. I'm
yes.
not going to go into greater detail.
Okay.
Is there something about the particular culture of fraternities that would lead to these kinds of accidents?
Well, there's two things, yes.
Or is it just kids being knuckleheads?
Well, it's definitely the knucklehead factor. But fraternities have two old traditions. One, of course, is hazing, and then the other is stunts and crazy, you know, sort of crazy extreme behavior. Some scholars think that all of that intense injury and sort of physical violence that goes on is tied to the fact there was a great anxiety in the 19th century that people would think you were homosexual if you you were in a fraternity. Why are these men choosing to live alone without any women? Why are they, you know, sleeping in the same house and eating in the same house and being off sometimes in a remote location that early fraternity houses were? And that the idea of being sort of really macho, aggressively macho, would protect you from this stigma of being considered homosexual.
So is that why all this paddling takes place?
Yeah. Well, paddling really came out of the military academies, and where you would get caned as part of the discipline. I think it was seen as kind of a humiliating thing, not just the part of the anatomy, but it was associated with small boys and the way you would discipline or punish a child. And that just has taken on a life of its own. There's been kids who have lost a kidney through intense paddling. That's how, when you add that alcohol to it, and they are just completely lose control of what they're doing, and kids have been terribly injured with paddling.
Well, it seems like an opportunity for guys to indulge in their most sadistic sides.
You know, fraternities are absolutely attractive to sadists. Not that fraternities are full of sadists, not that most fraternities have sadists in them, but if you have a guy who's really on campus who's really interested in kind of inflicting weird punishment on people who have to accept or tolerate it, he's going to be attracted to fraternity life.
Of course, he's going to say, well, I went through it myself first.
Exactly, exactly. And there is a sense that kids who go in who aren't in any way sadistic sort of go through it, and there's a lot of kids who drop out after pledging and say, I don't want to do that to anyone else. Maybe I'll stick through it through this, but when it comes to the new year, I'm dropping out. So there is some attrition around that. But then the ones who don't drop out, and I think there's a brutalization that goes on with that, the very notion when you get out of college that you did take part in that, in hurting these other people, can be very psychologically damaging. Although there are many, many fraternity chapters where things aren't like this at all and that do run exemplary programs, and the insurance industry is frustrated that reporters don't write about things that go well in fraternities, and there are a lot of things that do go well, but this article was about the bad side.
What about insurance? Don't the frat houses have their own insurance, or don't the nationals have insurance?
There's a tremendous amount of insurance. All of it is paid for by the undergraduate members, who incorrectly assume that that insurance is going to protect them from liability. And in reality, it protects the fraternity from them. The insurance is there so that if some knucklehead kid does something wrong, there'll be a fund of money from which to pay out the claim. But it's not necessarily – it's certainly not insurance against any bad behavior a kid takes part in.
So many frat members are 18, 19-year-olds. If they are separated from the national fraternity, who ends up footing their legal bills? Is it just their parents?
It is their parents. And I'm pretty convinced that the majority of parents of sons in fraternities don't realize this, that if he gets cut off from his fraternity insurance, the plaintiff's going to recover money against mom and dad's homeowner's insurance. And after that, if the kid needs a legal defense, that's going to be paid for by his parents because there's no public defenders in civil litigation.
Did you find in looking at fraternities any positives to the story?
Definitely. As I say, you can absolutely supercharge your degree in these tough economic times. You suddenly have this whole network of people who can help you get jobs. The fraternities are huge in the powerhouse fields of law, business, and politics, and it's an automatic network that your school might not have.
And I'm sure fraternities have reputations. If you are thinking of going into a fraternity, you might check around and find out which ones are the craziest, which ones are Animal House, and which ones might be a bit more serious.
Yes, on principle, but there's one refinement I would make, which is that fraternities by design are sort of franchise operations with terrible quality control. You can get a Big Mac in Cleveland, and it looks like a Big Mac in San Diego. You could go to Sigma Chi on one campus. It's an exemplary program. The next campus, it's beyond Animal House. So you want to look into the chapter you want to join as opposed to the national.
Now, we're talking about fraternities. What about sororities? Do they also have a high risk and lots of lawsuits?
Sororities, in something that I thought was very sexist when I was going to college and now seems to be their great saving grace, they're not allowed to have alcohol in the sorority houses, and they're not allowed to have these kind of parties. And because of those, so that while there's still a tremendous amount of drinking in sororities and you're risk factor for binge drinking goes way up if you join Greek life, they don't have the liability risks, anything like it, that fraternities have.
I would imagine that the Animal House factor also helps universities recruit. If a school has a reputation for being a party school, that's often seen as a positive.
Right. Well, sometimes we just think of those top students that are going up to the most elite colleges, and we get this impression that all colleges in America are hard to get into. Most colleges aren't hard to get into. Most colleges are desperate for students. Most colleges aren't Princeton and Yale turning kids away. Most colleges are trying to fill their beds. And when mom and dad are bringing lackluster John Jr. on campus, who probably isn't even ready to go to college, he suddenly gets very interested when he sees all this partying going on. Maybe it's not going to be homework and harassment like high school was. Maybe it's going to be fun, and mom and dad like it because now Johnny's willing to go to college. So the colleges are dependent on the fraternities for all that social programming and all that fun.
And then you say the frat alumni is a great source of fundraising for many universities.
Huge, absolutely huge, and they respond very quickly if their chapters are in any way hurt or curtailed by the college.
Haven't some private colleges kicked fraternities off campus following accidents? Bowdoin in Maine, for example?
Yes, definitely. Private colleges do have the right to determine any kind of private behavior. Look at Christian colleges and the things that they require as far as religious observation within the college that you could never do at a public university. There have been some private colleges that have kicked them off, but what you'll find over time is that, you know, they do come back over time. They'll open up in another house. They'll change their name. And National will, some kids from that had been in a National will choose new Greek letters and be off campus. And in the fullness of time, they'll often work their way back in.
Well, but when they're gone, does that mean that there is less alcohol consumption at a school like Bowdoin?
That's never been specifically studied on the school level. It's certainly been studied in terms of alcohol-free fraternity life. There's one huge fraternity, National Fraternity Phi Delta Theta. They went alcohol-free housing 15 years ago. Their risk and liability has gone way down. So I think parents who are looking for a fraternity for their son should look into his perhaps pledging Phi Delta. It's not perfect. There are still lawsuits, but it's a much safer fraternity in general.
At some other schools, I get the sense that a university president can get into a lot of political trouble if he takes on the Greek system.
It's no win. I can't understand why anybody would want to go into college administration. It is no win either way. And with the fraternity life.
Well, some of them make millions of dollars.
I guess that is why. But there seems to be tremendous harassment. And that may even be part of the problem is the millions of dollars themselves and what that attracts them to do. You can get in trouble with alumni if you curtail Greek activity. You can get in trouble legally if you try to supervise it too much because then your university might get sued. It's a really tricky question for these presidents.
Well, there are a lot of lawsuits against these fraternities. How often do they result in a payout?
We don't really know because so many of them settle out of court. Well, with settlement, you know, there is a settlement. You don't know how much. Usually it's confidential. A lot of times they'll just pay off on the insurance claim before going forward to trial at all or before even going into a lawsuit. So it's really hard to know.
And do we have a sense that after it has gone to court that the fraternity will change a bit and change some of their policies?
What they'll do is they'll add new policies into their risk management. They'll add more things that can get you cut off from the insurance. Does it really change life campus to campus in the different chapters? I haven't seen compelling evidence that it has.
And you write that articles like yours are a source of profound frustration for the fraternity industry. How was your reporting received? Have you been getting a lot of feedback?
I was really surprised how positively it was received by the fraternity industry, and that again made me feel that they were at the top of a somewhat ethical, much more ethical than I had assumed group of people. I received an email from someone really highly placed saying, thank you for bringing this up. Thank you for letting people know that we don't condone this behavior, that we're not there to cover up for anybody who commits a crime, and that we're not going to give them insurance coverage for doing things we told them not to do.
So they see your article as, in a way, freeing them from liability.
Yes, I think
it's a warning.
I think you're absolutely right. Yes.
Caitlin Flanagan's article in Atlantic Magazine, where she's a contributing editor, is called The Dark Power of Fraternities. We have a link to it on our show page at WNYC.org. But you might want to get the whole magazine. It's in the March issue of the magazine. Caitlin, thank you so much for being on our show again.
Thanks for having me.